Welcome to the South Shore's Morning News Weekend Review Podcast. I'm Rob Hackelall. Listen for the next 30 minutes as we take a look back at some of the big interviews from the week on the South Shore's Morning News, which airs live weekdays from 5 to 10 a.m. And good morning. We continue on the South Shore's Morning News. I'm Rob Hackelaw. Thanks for being here today. In this segment, Callie Siskel joins us. She is the author of Arctic Revival, winner of the Poetry Society of America Chapbook Fellowship, and has a new book of poems that investigates the enduring pain and transformative potential of grief. Her first full-length collection of poems is called Two Minds, and Callie joins us now. Callie, good morning. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
It's so good to have you on the program. Tell us about this collection and what this book means to you, because I understand some parts of the project have been in the works for about 10 years.
Yeah. I started writing these poems in a master's program over 10 years ago in Baltimore at Johns Hopkins University. And I've been working on it ever since. It is a coming-of-age story, in part, about losing my father at age 12. And for that reason, the book is very expansive and has taken me a very long time to get right. And I'm so excited that it's finally published.
And this book is, of course, dedicated for your father. Tell us about him. You were only 12 years old when you lost him?
Yes, I was 12 years old when I lost my dad, Gene Siskel. He was a film critic. And I knew him more, of course, as just my dad. And part of writing this book was, in a way, remembering and reinstating our personal relationship, because since he's passed, I've learned so much about him through others, through watching clips on YouTube of his television show with Roger Ebert. Basically, I've learned about him from others. And so I wanted to remember our relationship and the brief time that we had, and writing these poems helped me do that.
What do you remember most about your father?
I remember most the way he engaged me in looking at the world. He was always pointing things out. Whenever we had idle time, he made up games for us to play together. He asked me how to spell words, what I noticed. I think he was really interested in what I thought, and that was very encouraging, and I think is part of why I'm a writer, looking at the world and feeling emboldened to express myself.
Wow. Well, what drew you to writing poetry specifically, and how did it turn into your career?
I think it started really soon after he passed away. I was looking for something in a form to express my sense of loss. And I think poetry is something that young people gravitate to, in part because it's sort of like keeping a diary at first. You're writing down these sort of daily thoughts and feelings. And there's something that's very consoling about knowing that you can express yourself in these sort of short bursts. Something about fiction and novels have always felt like this longer project. Poetry is very immediate and visceral. And I also found that poetry was this perfect way to have a dialogue with him. I write in the first person. I usually refer to him in my poems as my father instead of in the second person, you. But I feel like I'm speaking to him when I invoke his name or I invoke the phrase my father. I feel like we're together in those moments. And poetry can often bring the first person speaker and the person that's being written about into very close proximity.
One of the poems that I really liked reading was Emissary, and you talked about, talking to your father. You talk about going to the same school, and what was that like to imagine that, you know, you were walking in the same places where he walked or experiencing some of the same things? What was that like?
Yeah, thank you for saying that. That's an example, too, of how poetry helps kind of solidify memory, because my father and I both went to Yale, and I was in the same dorm as he was. And I think that I didn't think about it that much at the time. I was, you know, a self-absorbed 18 to 22-year-old.
Yeah.
I had a lot on my mind that was pretty insubstantial, and also, you know, of course, classes. But as I was writing this book, the meaning of that resonance and that sense of being where he was took shape. And so that's an example, I think, of how poetry allows us to return to the past and actually protect and sort of sculpt memory so that it's preserved for the future. I feel like I was able to actually create a memory of having been in that space and feeling his presence, when in fact, I don't know if I did as much as I wanted to at the time.
Well, I know, speaking of returning to the past, I know you're based in California now, but I understand recently you were back in Chicago, your home city, your home area, to talk about the book. What was that like to go back to Chicago?
Oh, thank you for asking that. Yeah, it was really, it was poignant. It was all of the emotions. I grew up there, and of course, that's where I lived with my family, and then I haven't lived there since I was 18. I do visit from time to time, but this was really special. I was interviewed by the Chicago Tribune, which is where my dad worked for many years as a columnist. In addition to his television show, he wrote the reviews for the Tribune. And I was in the WGN radio tower, and I'm sure my dad was there looking out at the lake. And I definitely felt very close to him in a different way than I feel when I'm reminiscing about him from Los Angeles. So it was really beautiful. And at the reading I gave, people who knew my dad more than they knew me came and showed up and told me that I looked just like him, which is a common thing. And it was just nice to be reminded of him as someone who lived and loved Chicago.
Yeah. Well, as someone that grew up in the 80s and 90s, as, you know, in high school and then going into college, I remembered your dad just as being the giant, as in such kind of, I don't know how to describe, for me, just happy times, you know, the 80s and the 90s. And it seemed like that he was part of it. So, you know, that's why I wanted to talk to you, because that's what we experienced, and then that's why I wanted you to kind of talk about what it was like just for him as a father.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, and I also have that nostalgia for that time as well.
Yeah. Is it true? I have to ask this story because I've read it a few times about your dad, and I didn't know this, about being such a huge fan of Saturday Night Fever that he bought John Travolta's. Is that really a true story?
Yeah, that is a true story. I have a poem. This is the only poem in the book, I should add, that really talks about my dad as a film. I mean, you wouldn't know he was a film critic per se from the poem, but a film lover, clearly. And that's because of the reasons I mentioned earlier, that for me, it was important to remember him as my dad. But I actually heard that story, that he bought the suit and was obsessed with Saturday Night Fever, from my mom, of course, and from Roger Ebert, who lived longer than my dad and was able to tell me and my family stories about him as well. And then, of course, we had the suit in our house growing up until it was sold. And so I remember seeing it. And that poem is based on opening the bag that it hung in for a very long time.
Do you like, when I think about my own father and grandfather, I like when people do tell me stories that come up to me and they say, you know, that I worked with your dad, so-and-so. And I still hear from different people that reach out to the radio station because they recognize the last name, Hakala, and it's not very common. But I don't know, somehow that makes me still feel happy again to hear about other people that experienced, whether it be, do you feel that, like, who worked with your dad or were friends with your dad?
I think I do now, and it's not that I didn't before, but there was something really essential for me about writing this book and remembering him, as I said, as my father, and not allowing other people's memories to replace my own, if that makes sense. I think that because I was 12, I just really felt like my memories were sort of slipping away, and what was being remembered instead was what other people were telling me. So now that I feel like I've spent so long exploring, in some ways fabricating, as I mentioned with the Yale poem Emissary, you know, creating a world where my dad and I have this very full and long-standing relationship beyond his death, now I feel much more ready to take in other people's stories. And I feel delighted and I feel honored. And I always felt honored and so proud that he had an impact on so many people.
Yes, yes. Callie Siskel is with us today. Her book of poems is called Two Minds. And what does the future hold for you, Callie? What's next?
Well, I definitely want to keep writing poetry. I love it. And so I'm working on a second book of poems. I also graduated last year with a PhD in creative writing. So my goal is to be a professor. I love teaching. I've taught as part of my graduate degree and my two degrees in creative writing. And I think it's such an important subject, especially for college students. I think it's really essential as a coming-of-age class where you think about yourself, your position in the world, your subjectivity, And I think all college students should take creative writing, and I'd love to teach them.
Oh, that's great. Creative writing, yeah. And the legacy continues, and the next generation, and I understand you're also a new mom.
Yeah. I have a 9-month-old.
Oh, my.
And it's been a really fun collision of good things in my life. And having the book come out, with being a new mother, it's put everything in perspective. It's taken the pressure off the book in some sense because I have other obligations and I feel so fulfilled with my daughter. And it's also just been a really beautiful way of thinking about life continuing, as you say, with the sense that I've been absorbed in grief for a very long time writing this book. And now I feel very excited about the future with my family.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to share with us. And for those of us, so many I know listening, including myself, that just got to experience a piece of your dad. And I can say, just from observing, and it's so fun to watch now that we do have YouTube videos to go back and to see how bright and witty and just a great man, and what it must have been like to have him as your father, and how proud you are and how proud he must be of you.
That is so nice to hear. This has been so wonderful, and your enthusiasm is really meaningful.
Well, thank you, Callie, for being with us. Callie Siskel, the book is Two Minds. Thank you, Callie.
Thank you.
South Shore's Morning News, great to have you here. Bob Taravecchia, he is the chair and CEO of Coastal Heritage Bank. This segment sponsored proudly by Coastal Heritage Bank, one community, many individuals, one bank that is perfect for you, Coastal Heritage Bank. Growing together, member FDIC, member DIF. Bob, good morning and welcome back.
Hey, thanks so much. It's great to be back.
You had a good business trip?
We did, yeah. We were down at the Massachusetts Bankers Association. We had our annual conference, and I was down in Florida. Very nice, with about 75 other bankers from around Massachusetts, and we had some great guest speakers, and it was really a very, learned a lot. Always learn a lot when you go to those things, and the fellowship is really one of the things that we're really blessed with. We have a very vibrant community banking community in Massachusetts, and it's very collegial. It's competitive, no doubt. It's competitive, but it's the type of thing where at the end of the day, I think we're all trying to do right by our communities and try to build up the places that we all serve and help people buy homes and make their businesses better. So it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, well said,
Speaking
Bob.
Of fellowship,
yeah.
I went to Tim Cahill was on earlier. I went to the Quincy Rotary 100th anniversary last night. I saw Tim.
Oh yeah,
what a wonderful event at the Neighborhood Club, and they did a wonderful job, great job. Mike Wilcox, who works at Coastal, colleague of ours, he's going to be the president of the Weymouth, incoming Quincy Rotary president. So we had a big table there of Coastal Heritage Bank employees, and we were supporting the great things that the Quincy Rotary Club does. And I actually attended the Weymouth 100th anniversary last month.
Oh, wow.
At Precinct 10. Yeah, so all of these clubs are, they've been around a long time. And I'll tell you, the Quincy Rotary Club and the Weymouth Rotary Club, very, very vibrant. And the Braintree one as well. Very vibrant clubs. And if you're looking for things to do that is good for the community, it's a great place to check out as a Rotary Club.
Yeah, it is. It's wonderful. And it's great when you talk about something being around 100 years to know that it has been vibrant, and it's great to know that there is still many people, because sometimes over the years, these type of things, sometimes the membership drops off or it just doesn't have the same kind of energy that it did. And it's nice to know that those clubs are still very active, as are many Rotary clubs, and kudos to everybody that's involved in keeping those going. So Bob,
no doubt,
let's see, the week of the topic of the week here, you sent Christine and myself over this doc. I have not had a chance to fully read this yet.
I don't expect you to, but I just wanted to give you a heads up. So on Monday of this week, the report came out from the trustees report for the annual Social Security and Medicare trust fund reports. And these reports come out on an annual basis, and they simply do some actuarial calculations about the financial strength of our Social Security system in the United States. And there were a couple of headlines that, it's funny how reporters can one headline from this was a commentary from the Daily Signal the headline was four cold hard facts from Social Security trustees report and three common misconceptions. And then from the Wall Street Journal, there was an article, Social Security funds are running dry. Don't panic. So, you know,
that's not
what
reassuring.
Like, right?
No. Scary.
Not reassuring, Christine.
It's not reassuring.
Don't panic.
And, you know, I had a question for you, too. I've never been quite clear on this. When they say with the funds running out, this is not a separate fund. It's not like it's in a, you know, interest-bearing account. Isn't this pretty much in a general fund, and that's where they grab the money from?
Yeah, that's a great question. In preparing for our segment this morning, as I'm wont to do, I did some research and I learned about this. And this is something I'm embarrassed to say at my age. I ought to know how this works. So if you recall back in 1983, Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan, you remember that big summit they had and they got together and they reformed Social Security. So from that point forward up until from like 1984 till about 2021, for that roughly 40-year stretch, Social Security income from our payroll taxes, right? We pay it FICA taxes that comes out of our salary, and it's matched by our employer. That the revenues and into Social Security exceeded the amounts that were being paid out, okay? So that surplus for that 40 years, that surplus, Christine, and this is the question you're asking for, built up to a peak of about almost $3 trillion in 2021.
A surplus.
Yep, there was a surplus in that fund. So the fund, Social Security took in about $3 trillion, just to make the round. $3 trillion more than it paid out over that period of time.
That's great then.
It is great. So what they did with the money is they basically lent it to the federal government. So the federal government issued IOUs to the Social Security trust funds.
Okay, a little piece of
paper. And the federal government spent it.
Uh-huh.
So now, since 2021, what's happened is, and this is a demographic challenge for us. You know, there was an article that came out about 2 weeks ago that the U.S. Native population continues to decline, right? I think, I forgot what the number was, but it was a replacement rate is like 2.3 kids per couple. We're below replacement rate. So what's happening is it's a demographic game, whereas, you know, when Social Security was set up way back when, there might have been, I don't know, making the number up, 15 people paying in for every person that was taking out.
Yeah.
Those numbers are quickly declining. I believe it's like 4-1 now. Four workers for every beneficiary.
I don't know about you guys, but
it's going to get worse.
Yeah, because when I was a kid, and you know, that was the kind of thing that was the most basic thing I knew is that you know all the young people pay so that the older people can, you know, have the money, or they get the money that they paid in, or that kind of thing. But it always seemed like it would just keep going because you'd always have enough younger people to have. But you know, I imagine when they invented it, they didn't think we'd be living longer or having healthier lives, I guess. But so where are we now? Because it seemed like we had a good system and we had a surplus. So what happened?
Yep.
Is this just all, again, just greed and taking it out to pay for other things?
Well, I think it's the way Social Security set up. I think Social Security is exactly what you just said, Robert. It's the demographics. You know, folks are living longer, and so what happens is, and there are fewer births at the bottom of the funnel, you know. So to your point, you know, the system is designed as an intergenerational system where younger people take care of older folks. And it's a promise that the younger generations, the working folks, will take care of the older folks, which is a great system.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we remember, well, I don't remember, but you remember reading about, you know, in the pre-Social Security days where a lot of older folks were just living in abject poverty.
Awful.
Which is unacceptable,
yeah.
You know. So, by 2033, those IOUs are going to run out. Because so what's happening is now that there's a deficit in the trust fund, the difference between what's coming in and what's being paid out, Social Security goes to the federal government and cashes in those bonds. But that's simply just – so what does the federal government do? They don't have money. They just turn around and issue treasury bills. So they're borrowing. They're putting it on their credit card. It's like taking off one credit card to pay off – another
I don't
credit
know.
Card.
Like Christine,
that's
Bob,
what
is the answer? What do we need? Like, we need to get rich quick. We need to get the money back. I don't know if we should
foreclose
on the federal government.
Yeah, let's put it all into Bitcoin or.
No,
Maybe.
Yeah, that's a great idea, Rob.
To? Let's call Shohei Ohtani's translator and see if he can gamble it and get us double our money back.
So these are all unpalatable. Yeah. I think there's a whole litany of things that. Well, first of all, we're going to have to raise taxes if we want to have benefits like we have now. We're going to have to raise taxes. We have to pay for it. Secondly, we have to raise the we may have to raise the retirement age. Look what happened to Macron out in France when he tried to raise it from I think 60 to 62. He had riots.
I don't think would people go as nuts here? I don't think so. I feel like in Europe they've had it too easy for too long. But,
correct.
I feel like we yep. would. I mean, I don't know about you, but I think most of us expect to be working into our 70s. If I can
sure.
go till 80, if they can wheel me in, I'll keep doing it.
But Bob, just to be play devil's advocate here, something I've never understood about Social Security, it's a regressive yeah. tax. They tax you twice. They shouldn't be able to get away yes. with that.
Yeah,
that whole the whole system should be changed because they get you in every single step.
I know it, Christine. It's just think about it. It's just so unpalatable.
Yes,
it's
it is.
The third rail of politics.
If you
nobody will touch it.
And if you had invested that same money you put away in very very what's the word I'm looking for? I would say conservative investments, you would do a lot better than what's being paid out in Social Security.
Yeah,
and they keep defending it, so I don't get it.
There are studies. There are studies that show that, and then other economists would dispute that and say that if there was ever a depression and the stock market took a big hit, that private wealth would evaporate, and then those folks would be back on the government dole. So, it's interesting you say that, Christine. There's a lot of conflicting data about that.
Should be tax free though.
They don't want to, Christine. They don't want to touch it.
Yeah. No, they should. Yeah. It should be tax free after they've already gotten you once.
That's a good point. Yeah, I mean, I guess trying to always
that'll be
get
part
you.
Of my platform.
Yeah. Thank you, Christine.
I love it.
Running for Hall
Christine,
Monitor here in
Christine for president.
Oh no, yeah. Thank you.
Kate from Duxbury wanted to say someone wise said Rotary is a, quote, secret club for do-gooders. It's the best, says Kate from Duxbury.
Oh, thank you very much. That's very well said.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Kate. Thanks, gang. See you next week.
Talk bye-bye. Soon.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
.95.9 WATD, the South Shore's Morning News. Rob Hackelow with the morning team. It's time we check in with the South Shore Chamber of Commerce. Peter Foreman is in studio with us this week. Peter is the chair and CEO of the South Shore Chamber of Commerce, president and CEO, Peter Foreman. Peter, good morning. Good to see you.
It's great to be here. I was listening to you viewing the new Jerry Seinfeld movie. And
you Unfrosted.
You and Dan were getting very nostalgic for childhood, so I popped in this morning at the grocery store to see if they still make Pop-Tarts.
Oh, look at this. You guys want to dig in?
No, we'll wait till after.
Okay. This is Frosted Strawberry, a classic. Pop-Tarts, proudly baked in the USA. Kellogg's. Yeah, this was the story. It's a fictional story, but it's a lot of fun that kids love Pop-Tarts by Kellogg's, and they did not go for Country Squares by Post. That was the original name of the Post product, Country Squares.
Well, it's a great old product. I remember it. This morning, we're actually going to explore the story behind another brand product. But this one's a little more local. It's about South Shore Magazine, published by Stan Blackmer, who is a member of the Chamber Board of Directors. And we often explore in these segments interesting stories about how businesses are navigating the risks they're taking. And South Shore Magazine is launching a new product, the Neponset Valley Metro South Magazine. And I thought kind of interesting when people thought print was going to die 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. Here we are expanding into another product. So I thought it would be great to bring Stan on to kind of talk about a small business looking at how you expand in this environment.
Oh, I think that's a great idea, and it's good to have Stan back in here at WATD alum, Stan Blackmore. Stan, good morning.
Good morning.
You know him for many years from South Shore Live on the radio on Monday nights. And so, of course, all through this, before and even after the radio show, you've been busy in the publishing world. So let's talk about the print industry. It can be a tough market. So what made you decide to launch a new product, Stan, and tell us about the magazine?
So South Shore Magazine, we've been publishing in, coming up in January, it'll be our 25th year of publishing South Shore Magazine. We are not a regular magazine format. We are a specialty niche publication that's direct mail, and we mail to 15,000 of the highest tax assessed valued homes from Milton through Plymouth, coastal distribution. And we also have a digital edition, which is the same, and we have about 16,000 readers for that. The idea for launching the Ponca Valley Metro South magazine, something I've been thinking about a little bit over the last couple of years, but if interaction being on the board at the South Shore Chamber and leadership South Shore with South Shore Bank, was having dealings with the Metro South Chamber of Commerce and was just kind of got intrigued by what was going on in that region, and then took a deeper dive into it over the winter to investigate what other publications, if there were any, were in that area, and discovered that there is only one franchise type magazine in the town of Westwood that I've uncovered so far. So taking that into consideration, I thought that it might be a viable market for a product such as South Shore Magazine. So we will start in distribution in Dedham, go down 95 to Mansfield, Foxborough, go over east through the Bridgewaters, and then up through Brockton to Stoughton on Route 24. So 14 towns in that region will have a similar model.
Yep.
The magazine consists of house and home, health and wellness. We have a section called Our Community, which focuses on the nonprofit organizations in our regions. Mm-hmm. And then we have a section called Great Taste, which encompasses the food and beverage
industries. Oh, nice. Okay. All right. So this will be the new magazine, the Ponset Valley Metro South Magazine, and you already have South Shore Magazine. So they're both south of Boston. So, Stan, how do you think the areas complement each other or differ? Do you expect any crossover with content or advertising?
I think there will definitely be crossover with advertising because there are businesses that do business all over Massachusetts. But we already have some people that have stepped up that are interested in both publications that have advertised in South Shore. I feel that the Metro South and the Ponset Valley areas are growing significantly. Mm-hmm. And have more of a draw from Boston than, especially in the upper parts of the Neponset Valley, than we do in some parts of the South Shore. But I think they complement each other very much. There are a lot of similarities, but there are also some regional differences between the two areas.
Hmm. Well, I know we're just about out of time, but I wanted to just, if you could leave some people with some advice, because you've been somebody that's taken a chance, you've changed careers at times, you've taken a look at that. What advice would you give to somebody, an entrepreneur, somebody that wants to start their own business, Stan, from you?
First and foremost, you got to believe in yourself.
Yeah.
And have the ability to roll with the punches and ride the waves of a new business. But you also have to really believe in your product or your service. It's something that's extremely important, whether it's you're doing something brick and mortar or you're doing a consulting business. You have to be gregarious. You have to believe in yourself, and you have to get out there and put yourself out there no matter what your comfort level is. But that, I believe, in anybody starting a business, those are the key elements, and clearly having some funding too. But I think the most important part is believing in yourself and believing in your product.
Yeah. Stan Blackburn with us, publisher of South Shore Magazine, and he's got his new magazine coming out in the Ponset Valley Metro South Magazine. Stan, thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast. As always, you can find us on your radio at 95.9 FM. mornings from 5 to 10, or online at 95.9WATD.com.
And you can catch up with us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. You can get the links at 95.9WATD.com/SS Morning News. And join us next week for another edition of the South Shore's Morning News Week in Review.